Story one, damn GPS. That's what started this whole nightmare. My name's Ryan. I drive for a living, long-haul deliveries across Florida for a medical supply company. Usually I stick to the main highways, but that day back in 2018, there was a massive pileup on E75, and I was already running late on a time-sensitive delivery. "Rerouting," said the robotic voice, directing me down some county roads I'd never seen before. It was late September, brutally hot even for Florida, and my AC was struggling to keep up. The unfamiliar route took me through patches of swampy wilderness, broken up by random trailer parks and dollar stores. Nothing unusual for rural Florida. Then I hit Gibsonton. I didn't even know the name until later. At first, it just seemed like another small town. Rundown houses, a few storefronts with faded signs, palm trees fighting for life in cracked parking lots. But something felt off. I slowed down as I passed what looked like an old motel. In the parking lot was the strangest collection of vehicles I'd ever seen. Decorated trailers with peeling paint showing faded images of tigers, clowns, World's Strongest Man. There were vintage trucks with words like Funhouse and Hall of Mirrors stenciled on their sides. A guy was working on one of the trucks, and when he stood up, I nearly swerved off the road. He was the tallest human being I'd ever seen, had to be over 7 feet. Next to him was a woman who couldn't have been more than 4 feet tall. That's when it clicked. This was the place I'd heard about, where carnival workers lived during the off-season. I would have kept driving, but my delivery van started making this horrible knocking sound. The temperature gauge shot into the red. Perfect timing. I pulled over near what looked like a convenience store. The sign just said Market in crooked letters. I figured I'd get some water for the radiator and maybe ask for directions to the nearest auto shop. The little bell above the door jingled when I walked in. The air inside was thick and smelled like incense and tobacco. Behind the counter stood a man with the most extensive facial tattoos I'd ever seen outside of Instagram. His entire face was covered in a pattern that made him look like some kind of big cat. A leopard, maybe. Hi, I said. My van's overheating. You got water I could buy for the radiator? He stared at me without blinking. Out back, hose by the propane tank. His voice was surprisingly normal. Thanks. Is there a mechanic nearby? He picked up a phone without taking his eyes off me. Earl, he said after a moment, got a normie with car trouble. He hung up. He'll be here. 10 minutes. I nodded and headed out back to find the hose. That's when I noticed the trailers behind the store. There were about a dozen of them arranged in a semicircle. Most looked abandoned, but one had lights on inside. As I filled a bucket with water, I heard music start up from that trailer. An old carousel tune that seemed to skip every few seconds. Something about it raised the hair on my arms. I was heading back to my van when a voice called out, "You lost, friend?" I turned to see a bald guy leaning against one of the trailers. Everything about him seemed wrong. His proportions were off somehow. His arms were too long for his body, and his head seemed slightly too big. "Just waiting for Earl," I said. "My van's overheating." He smiled. His teeth were filed to points. "Earl ain't no mechanic," he said. "He's our caretaker." He pushed off from the trailer and took a step toward me. "You picked an interesting time to visit. It's the reunion tonight." "I'm not staying," I said quickly. "Just passing through." "Nobody just passes through here." His smile widened. "This place finds the people it wants." Before I could respond, a cluster of people emerged from between the trailers. There were about 8 of them. All with the same abnormalities. A woman with skin that hung in loose folds like melted wax. An elderly man whose spine curved so severely that he walked with his face almost parallel to the ground. Twins with identical faces that seemed frozen in permanent grins. They didn't say anything, just formed a loose circle around me. "What do you want?" My voice came out higher than I intended. The bald man laughed. "Want? We're just being neighborly. It's what small towns do." He gestured toward the lit trailer. "Come join us. We're celebrating." "Celebrating what?" "The joining," said the woman with the loose skin. Her voice was thick, like she was talking through pudding. "Every September, we choose someone to join our family." I backed away, clutching my bucket of water. I really need to fix my van. That's when I noticed the music had gotten louder. The carousel tune was now playing from speakers I couldn't see. "You know," said the bald man, stepping closer, "people think our kind of life is dying out. Carnival culture, sideshow attractions. But we found ways to ensure our traditions continue." The circle tightened around me. "I'm not special," he finished my sentence. "Everyone's special in some way. We just help reveal it." He reached toward my face with those two long fingers. "Some need more help than others." I threw the bucket of water at him and ran. Behind me, I heard laughter and the music getting louder. I sprinted back to my van, fumbled with the keys, and somehow got it started despite the overheating. As I peeled out, my rearview mirror showed them all standing in the road, watching me go. The bald man raised his hand in a wave. I drove that overheating van 30 miles before I dared to stop, steam pouring from under the hood. The weirdest part? When I checked Google Maps later that night from my motel room, I couldn't find Gibsonton. The route I'd taken showed nothing but swampland where that town should have been. But sometimes, especially when I'm driving late at night, I catch that carousel music on the radio for just a second before it turns to static. And in my bathroom mirror, I swear my arms look just a little bit longer than they used to. Story 2. I never thought I'd be the person telling a ghost story. Growing up in rural Minnesota, I'd roll my eyes at my grandmother's superstitions and laugh at friends who claimed to feel presences. That changed 3 years ago in a way I still can't explain. My husband Mark and I were struggling to find affordable housing in our overpriced market. With a baby on the way and both of us working modest jobs, we were getting desperate. That's when our realtor mentioned contract for deed options, basically owner financing for people with less than stellar credit. "There's this place over on Elmwood," she told us one Friday afternoon. "It's been sitting empty for a while. The family's motivated to sell." The following day, we picked up my sister Liz to come look at the place with us. Liz has always been my practical sounding board, the least superstitious person I know. She works in construction and can spot foundation issues from a mile away. The house looked decent from the outside, small two-bedroom with faded yellow siding, badly in need of landscaping, but structurally sound. Our realtor met us with the keys, looking uncomfortable. "The owner passed away suddenly," she explained, fidgeting with her phone. "His family cleared out most things, but some personal effects are still inside. They've authorized me to show it as is." The moment we stepped inside, something felt off, not in a supernatural way, just the strange intimacy of being in a dead person's home. Mail was still stacked on a small table by the door. A jacket hung on a hook nearby. "Feels like whoever lived here just stepped out for a minute," Mark whispered, voicing what we were all thinking. We moved through the living room, which was sparse but clean. The kitchen was outdated but spacious, with dark wood cabinets that needed refinishing. Liz immediately started checking the plumbing under the sink. "Water pressure seems fine," she said, standing up and looking around. "These cabinets are solid, though. They don't make them like this anymore." She ran her hand along one of the upper cabinet doors, pushing it firmly shut. It was the kind with a small magnetic latch that keeps it closed. As we continued examining the kitchen, Liz suddenly stopped and tilted her head, staring at a spot near the refrigerator. "Wait a second," she said slowly. "This address, I know this place." Mark and I looked at her questioningly. "This was Tony's house," she said, her voice dropping. "My son's baseball coach. He died last year. Had a heart attack right here in this kitchen." The realtor shifted uncomfortably. "Yes, that's correct. Mr. Andonelli was the owner." Liz shook her head in disbelief. "I can't believe I didn't make the connection. He was such a nice guy, always cracking jokes with the kids." And that's when it happened. The cabinet door directly behind Liz, the one she had just firmly closed, suddenly flew open with incredible force, swinging so hard it slammed into her back with a loud whack. Liz yelped and jumped forward, spinning around. We all stared at the cabinet door, which was now completely open, swinging slightly. "What the hell?" Mark said, looking around for an explanation. I felt the blood drain from my face. "Did you see that? It just flew open," the realtor finished, her voice barely audible. No one had been near it. The floor wasn't slanted. Liz had already checked that. The cabinet had been firmly latched shut, and it didn't just drift open. It shot open with enough force to startle all of us. Liz stood frozen, her hand on her lower back where the door had hit her. Then, instead of being frightened, she did something that...
Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.
That still gives me goosebumps. She looked up at the ceiling and said with absolute seriousness, "Okay, Tony, I get it. You're still here." The silence that followed was deafening. None of us moved. Then a strange calm settled over the kitchen, like the air pressure had suddenly normalized. "You knew him well?" I finally asked Liz, my voice shaking. "He was the funniest guy," she replied, still looking around the kitchen, "always playing practical jokes on everyone." The realtor cleared her throat. "Should we continue the tour?" We did finish looking at the house, but I couldn't shake what had happened. It wasn't subtle. The force behind that cabinet door was deliberate, like someone had pushed it. But there was no one there. Despite everything, Mark and I seriously considered making an offer. The price was right, and the house had good bones. But financing fell through at the last minute, and someone else bought it a week later. Story 3. I'm not one of those people who grew up believing in the supernatural. My dad was an electrical engineer, my mom a high school science teacher. Our house in suburban Michigan was all about logic and reason. Ghost stories were just entertainment, nothing more. That changed last winter. I just moved into this old apartment building in Detroit. Nothing fancy, just a third-floor walk-up in a converted factory from the 1920s. Exposed brick walls, creaky wooden floors, tall windows. It was cheap and close to work, so I didn't ask too many questions when I signed the lease. The first couple weeks were fine. Normal new apartment stuff, figuring out which light switches controlled what, learning the sounds of the building, that kind of thing. I'd wake up a few times hearing footsteps from the apartment above, but whatever, old buildings are noisy. Then the humming started. It was a Tuesday night around 2 a.m. when I first heard it. I'd fallen asleep watching some documentary on my laptop when this low, steady humming pulled me awake. At first, I thought it was just the refrigerator or maybe the building's heating system kicking on, but something about it felt different. It wasn't mechanical. It had a rhythm to it, almost like someone was humming a melody. I rolled over and tried to go back to sleep, but the sound kept going. After about 10 minutes, I got up to investigate. I checked the fridge, the bathroom fan, even unplugged every electronic device in my bedroom. Nothing stopped it. The weird thing was, I couldn't pinpoint where it was coming from. It seemed to be everywhere and nowhere at once. I even pressed my ear against the walls, thinking maybe it was coming from a neighboring apartment, but the sound didn't get any louder or softer. "Hello," I called out, feeling stupid immediately after. Of course, no one was going to answer, but the humming stopped, instantly, mid-note. I stood there in the dark, my heart suddenly racing. The silence felt heavier than the humming had been. I waited, listening for anything, but there was nothing. "Just the building settling," I mumbled to myself as I crawled back into bed. I almost had myself convinced until the humming started again, this time right beside my ear. I jumped out of bed so fast I knocked my lamp off the nightstand. The humming stopped again. I fumbled for my phone, turned on the flashlight, and scanned the room, my hands shaking so badly the light beam bounced wildly across the walls. Nothing. No one. Just my empty apartment. I didn't sleep the rest of that night, just sat on my couch with all the lights on until sunrise, telling myself it was just my imagination, just stress from the new job, just anything but what it felt like. The next night, nothing happened, or the night after. By the weekend, I'd almost forgotten about it. Almost. Then Sunday night came. I'd just gotten out of the shower around 10 p.m. when the bathroom suddenly felt cold. Not just cooler, freezing. I could see my breath. "What the hell?" I muttered, reaching for my towel. That's when the humming started again. The same melody, the same rhythm, only this time it was coming from inside the shower I'd just stepped out of. I froze, dripping wet, staring at the shower curtain. The humming grew louder, more insistent. Then the shower curtain moved, just slightly, a gentle billowing, as if someone had passed by behind it. "Who's there?" My voice cracked embarrassingly as I backed toward the door. The humming stopped. The curtain stopped moving. For a second, I thought maybe I'd imagined it all. Then a single, slow handprint pressed outward against the shower curtain from the inside. I ran. Didn't even grab clothes. Just bolted from the bathroom into my bedroom, slammed the door, and locked it. I called my friend Jake, who lived nearby. "Dude, there's someone in my apartment," I whispered frantically as soon as he picked up. "Call the cops," Jake said. "I can't explain it. I don't think it's a person." "What the hell does that mean?" I was about to try to explain when the humming started again, right outside my bedroom door. Then a soft knock, three gentle taps. "It's at my door," I whispered into the phone. "Jake, it's right outside my door." "I'm coming over," he said. "Stay on the phone." The doorknob slowly turned, testing against the lock. I backed away until I hit the window, clutching my phone like a lifeline. "Jake, the doorknob is turning by itself." "I'm in my car. 5 minutes. Just..." The humming grew louder, and my phone went dead. No warning, no low battery, just completely dead. At the same moment, the light in my bedroom flickered and went out. In the darkness, I heard the lock on my bedroom door click open. I scrambled to the window, ready to climb onto the fire escape, when the humming suddenly stopped. "Hello, David." It was a woman's voice, calm, almost sweet. But nobody had called me David since I was a kid. I'd started going by Dave in high school. Nobody in Detroit knew me as David. Nobody except my grandmother, who died when I was 11. And the humming, it was her lullaby, the one she used to sing to help me fall asleep. I turned around slowly. In the darkness, I could just make out a figure standing in my doorway. Not quite solid, more like a shadow with depth. "Grandma?" My voice was barely audible. The figure moved closer, and I caught the faint scent of lavender, her perfume. The temperature in the room plummeted. "I've been trying to reach you," the voice said. "I needed to warn you." Before I could ask what she meant, there was a pounding at my apartment door. Jake arriving. The figure turned toward the sound, then back to me. I felt something cold brush against my cheek, like fingers, but not quite solid. "Be careful who you trust," the voice whispered. Then the cold presence was gone. When Jake burst in moments later, he found me still standing by the window, shivering and only wrapped in a towel, staring at an empty doorway. I moved out the next day. Never went back except with friends to get my stuff. Never told anyone but Jake what really happened. I still don't know what my grandmother was warning me about, but I know what I heard, I know what I felt, and I know now that some things can't be explained away with logic and reason. Story 4. I never considered myself superstitious. Ghost stories, paranormal TV shows. I'd roll my eyes at all of it. I was studying psychology at UMASS Amherst, for God's sake. I knew how the mind played tricks, how people misinterpreted normal events as supernatural. That was until last January. I was renting this old Victorian house with two other students about a mile from campus. The place was gorgeous, but definitely showed its age. Creaky floorboards, drafty windows, the works. My room was on the second floor, at the end of a long hallway. One night I was up late finishing a paper. It was around 3 a.m. when I finally decided to call it quits. My roommates were both gone, one visiting family, the other staying at her boyfriend's place downtown. The house was dead silent except for the occasional settling sounds old houses make. As I was brushing my teeth, I heard a thud from down the hall. Not unusual in an old house, right? But then I heard what sounded like footsteps. "Hello?" I called out, toothbrush still in hand. "Megan? Jake? You guys back early?" Nothing, just silence. I poked my head out into the hallway. It was dark except for the dim light coming from my bathroom. I flipped the hall light switch. Nothing happened. Great. Another blown bulb. Using my phone flashlight, I walked down the hallway, checking the other bedrooms. Empty, just as they should be. I even checked downstairs, thinking maybe one of my roommates had come home without announcing themselves. Nothing. Doors locked, windows secure. I laughed at myself for being jumpy and headed back upstairs. That's when I saw it. At the end of the hallway, where there had always been a small bookshelf, stood a full-length antique mirror. I froze. My heart started pounding so hard I could feel it in my throat. "What the fuck?" I whispered to myself. There had never been a mirror there. I knew this house like the back of my hand after living there for 2 years. That mirror, ornate, with a tarnished gold frame, had never existed in our house. I stood there, unable to move, staring at it from about 15 feet away. The logical part of my brain started making excuses. Maybe Jake or Megan bought it and set it up before leaving? Maybe I somehow never noticed it before. I took a hesitant step forward, then another. The floorboards creaked beneath my feet. As I got closer, I could see my reflection appearing in the glass. Pale face, wide eyes, toothbrush still clutched in my hand. I was about 5 feet away when I noticed something wrong with my reflection. It wasn't moving in sync with me. When I stopped, it continued forward for a split second before stopping too. My blood ran cold. I couldn't breathe. Then my reflection smiled. I had to move my lips. I dropped my toothbrush and ran, flew back to my room, slammed the door, and locked it. I wedged my desk chair under the doorknob for good measure and backed away until I hit the far wall. For hours, I sat there on my bed, staring at the door, listening for any sound. My phone was at 2% battery, and my charger was in the living room. I wasn't about to go out there to get it. Eventually, exhaustion won out over terror, and I must have fallen asleep, because the next thing I knew, sunlight was streaming through my window. In the light of day, I felt foolish. I'd clearly been overtired, imagining things after pulling an all-nighter for my paper. I cautiously opened my bedroom door and looked down the hallway. The bookshelf was there. No mirror in sight. I almost convinced myself I'd dreamed the whole thing, until I remembered my toothbrush. I dropped it in the hallway. It wasn't there now. When my roommates came back that evening, I casually asked if either of them had ever seen an antique mirror in the house. "No, why?" Jake asked, giving me an odd look. "Just curious," I said. "I thought I remembered seeing one somewhere." "Well, there's never been one here," Megan said, dropping her bags on the floor. "But that reminds me. The landlord called while I was away. Apparently, the previous owner of this house had some weird stipulation in the will about keeping all the original furnishings in storage. He's coming by tomorrow to inventory what's here versus what should be here." "Did he mention anything specific?" I asked, trying to keep my voice steady. "Just some furniture," she shrugged. "Oh, and something about a mirror they can't find. Supposedly, it's really valuable." I didn't sleep at all that night, or the next. I moved out the following week, made up some excuse about finding a place closer to campus. My roommates thought I was crazy. Maybe I am. But I know what I saw. Story 5. I was never one for ghost stories or paranormal nonsense. Working nights as an EMT in Portland for 6 years, I'd seen plenty of strange things with perfectly rational explanations. Death, trauma, drugs. They can make people see all kinds of things that aren't there. Then last winter happened. I was filling in for a buddy on an overnight shift. Around 2 a.m., we got a call to the West Shore Hotel, an old place downtown that dates back to the 1920s. Dispatch said an elderly guest was having chest pains. When we arrived, the night manager met us in the lobby. He looked rattled. "Room 217, third floor." He handed me a key card. "The gentleman called down about 20 minutes ago. We tried calling back, but no answer." My partner, Ricky, grabbed the gurney while I headed for the elevator. The West Shore wasn't exactly a luxury hotel anymore, but it still had that faded elegance. Brass fixtures, crown molding, that musty smell old buildings get. The third floor hallway was dead quiet. Room 217 was at the far end. I knocked firmly. "Medical response, sir, can you open the door?" Nothing. I knocked again, louder. "Sir, we're coming in." I swiped the key card. The lock clicked, and I pushed the door open. The room was dark except for a bedside lamp. An elderly man in striped pajamas sat in an armchair by the window, looking out at the city lights. "Sir?" I'm Jake with Medical Response. You called about chest pain? He didn't turn around. I stepped closer, thinking maybe he was hard of hearing. Sir? As I approached, I noticed something odd. The chair wasn't fully facing the window. I should have been able to see his profile, but it was like his outline was blurry somehow. Sir, I need to check your vitals. I reached for his shoulder. My hand passed through him. I jerked back, adrenaline spiking through my system. The figure remained motionless, still gazing out the window. What the hell? I stumbled backward, nearly tripping over the bed. That's when my radio crackled. Ricky's voice came through. Jake, you there? What's going on? I couldn't speak. I was staring at the chair, where the figure was slowly fading, like someone turning down the opacity on a computer image. Within seconds, the chair was empty. I bolted for the door, my heart hammering. In the hallway, I found Ricky with the gurney. Room's empty, I managed to say. My voice sounded strange even to me. What? Dispatch said, I know, but there's nobody there. We did a quick sweep of the room together. Empty bathroom, bed made, no luggage, nothing. Back in the lobby, the night manager looked confused when we told him. That can't be right. Mr. Harmon checked in yesterday. He's been here before. Always gets the same room. He pulled up the records on his computer, then frowned. That's strange. The system shows room 217 as vacant for the past week. Then who called about chest pain? Ricky asked. The manager pulled up the call log. Call came from room 217 at 1:42 a.m. He looked up, his expression uneasy. But that's impossible if the room is empty. I felt cold despite the lobby's warmth. Has anything like this happened before? The manager hesitated, glancing at his coworker behind the desk, who suddenly became very interested in her computer screen. Well, he lowered his voice. Room 217 has a bit of a history. Back in the 60s, an older gentleman, regular guest, had a heart attack in that room. Story goes he died sitting in the chair by the window. He shrugged uncomfortably. Housekeeping sometimes reports items moved around or the chair being in a different position. Did you get his name? I asked, though I already knew the answer. Harmon, Edward Harmon. I've responded to thousands of calls in my career. Violent accidents, horrific injuries, deaths of all kinds. None of them shook me like that empty hotel room. I'm not saying I believe in ghosts now, but I'm a lot less quick to dismiss the things I can't explain. Story 6, I never thought working night audit at the Parkview Hotel would change my entire belief system, but here we are. I'm Mike, 32, from a small town outside Portland, where nothing interesting ever happens. That's why I moved to the city 5 years ago, for some excitement. Be careful what you wish for, I guess. The Parkview isn't some fancy chain hotel. It's this creaky old Victorian mansion built in 1885 that some developer converted into a boutique hotel back in the 90s. Most nights were uneventful. Check in late arrivals, balance the books, make sure nobody's having a party loud enough to disturb other guests. That night started like any other Tuesday. Low occupancy, quiet lobby, and me fighting to stay awake at 3 a.m. I was the only employee in the building besides Rosa, the night cleaner who usually kept to the service areas and lower floors. I was doing my hourly walkthrough of the main floor when my radio crackled. Mike, you there? Rosa's voice came through, shaky and uncertain. Yeah, what's up? Can you come to room 412? Something's wrong with the lights. I sighed, grabbing the master key card and maintenance kit. The fourth floor was the oldest section of the hotel, where most of our electrical issues happened. Probably just another blown fuse. On my way, I replied, heading for the stairs. The elevator in this place was unreliable at the best of times, and downright creepy at night with its grinding gears and flickering lights. Four flights of stairs later, I was slightly winded as I pushed open the door to the fourth floor hallway. The air felt different up here, heavier somehow, colder than the rest of the building despite our ancient heating system working overtime. Rosa, I called out, my voice sounding smaller than I intended. No answer. The hallway stretched ahead, dimly lit with those vintage sconces that barely illuminate anything. Room 412 was at the far end, past a bend in the corridor. I started walking, my footsteps muffled by the worn carpet. I tried the radio again, Rosa, I'm on the fourth floor. Where are you? Nothing but static in response. As I rounded the corner, I saw room 412 ahead. The door was ajar, spilling a wedge of light into the hallway. That was odd. Housekeeping protocol was to never leave doors open while cleaning, especially at night. Rosa? I called again, approaching the room. I pushed the door open wider and stepped inside. The room was empty. No Rosa, no cleaning cart. Just a perfectly made-up room, ready for guests. But the lights were on, all of them. The overhead, both bedside lamps, even the bathroom light. I reached for my radio again. Rosa, where'd you go? I'm in 412 now. The radio crackled with static, then went silent. I tried again with the same result. Great. The radio dead zones in this building were another thing on my list of complaints to management. I moved toward the light switch by the door, figuring I'd turn everything off and head back downstairs to find Rosa. My hand had just touched the switch when every light in the room went out simultaneously. Total darkness. I froze, my heart suddenly pounding. It wasn't just that the lights went out, it was how they went out. Not a flicker or fade, but all at once, like someone had cut the power to the entire room. Rosa, this isn't funny, I said, my voice sounding hollow in the darkness. No response. I fumbled for my phone in my pocket, turning on the flashlight. The beam cut through the darkness, illuminating the pristine hotel room. And that's when I heard it. A soft click. The sound came from behind me by the door. I spun around, my phone's light beam swinging wildly across the room. The door was closed. I hadn't closed it. I know I hadn't. My mouth went dry as I moved toward the door, telling myself there had to be a logical explanation. Old building, drafty windows, a door that didn't catch properly. When I reached for the handle, the lights came back on. All of them, at once, full brightness. I jerked my hand back from the door like it had burned me. What the hell? I whispered. Then I noticed something that made my blood run cold. The room was different, not in any dramatic way. It was subtle. The painting above the bed had changed position, tilting slightly to the left. The curtains were partially open now, though I distinctly remembered them being fully closed when I entered. And the bedspread, it had a small, distinct wrinkle that hadn't been there before. It was as if someone had moved around the room in those seconds of darkness. My hands shaking, I reached again for the door handle. The lights went out. This time, I didn't hesitate. I yanked the door open, stumbling out into the hallway. The corridor was pitch black. That wasn't possible. The emergency lights were on a separate circuit. They were supposed to stay on even during a power outage. I turned in what I thought was the direction of the stairs, my phone's flashlight barely penetrating the thick darkness ahead. Three steps forward, and I heard it again. Click. Behind me. I didn't look back. I just ran, my heart hammering in my chest, my breath coming in short gasps. The beam of my flashlight bounced wildly ahead of me as I sprinted down the corridor. I slammed into the stairwell door, fumbling with the handle until it gave way. I practically fell down the first flight of stairs, catching myself on the railing. Below me, I could see light, the lobby, normal, blessed light. I didn't stop running until I reached the front desk, where I collapsed into my chair, gasping for breath. The radio on the desk crackled to life. Mike! You there? Rose's voice came through, clear as day. I stared at the radio for a long moment before responding. Rosa, where are you? Second floor, almost done. Did you need something? Did you call me to room 412 earlier? There was a pause. Number, I've been on the second floor all night. Why? I never told Rosa what happened that night. I never told anyone until now. I still work at the Parkview, but I always find an excuse to send someone else when there's an issue on the fourth floor. In room 412? I mark it as under maintenance whenever I can get away with it. Some rooms should just stay empty. Story 7. I never gave much thought to ghosts or the paranormal. Growing up in a small mining town in northern Pennsylvania, we heard plenty of stories. Miners trapped in cave-ins, unexplained noises in abandoned shafts. But I always chalked it up to superstition and old-timers trying to scare us kids. That changed 3 years ago. I was working as a surveyor for the county, mapping out some old mining tunnels that were being considered for a historical preservation project. It wasn't exactly glamorous work, but the pay was decent, and I enjoyed the solitude sometimes. This particular day, I was in a section of the Blackwood mine that hadn't been operational since the 1950s. My partner Dave had called in sick, so I was flying solo. Not ideal, but I'd done it before, and these tunnels had been reinforced years ago for occasional tours that never really took off. The mine entrance was about a 30-minute hike from where I'd parked my truck. It was mid-October, chilly but not too cold yet. The forest was all oranges and reds, leaves crunching under my boots as I made my way to the entrance. "Just another day at the office," I muttered to myself, switching on my headlamp before ducking into the mine. The first hour was routine. I took measurements, made notes, snapped photos of structural points of interest. The only sounds were my footsteps echoing off the stone walls and the occasional drip of water from the ceiling. Around 2 p.m., I reached a fork in the tunnel. According to my maps, the left path had been thoroughly documented already, but the right tunnel still needed work. I checked my equipment, took a swig from my water bottle, and headed right. This section was noticeably different. Older support beams, narrower passages. The air felt heavier somehow, staler. I remember thinking it was strange that the temperature seemed to drop several degrees, even though I was heading deeper, where it should have been warmer, if anything. "Focus, Mark," I said to myself, my voice sounding flat in the dense air. I continued taking measurements, moving deeper into the tunnel. That's when my headlamp flickered, just for a second, but enough to make my heart skip a beat. When you're hundreds of feet underground, your light source isn't just convenient, it's your lifeline. "Come on, don't do this to me," I muttered, tapping the side of the lamp. It stabilized and I exhaled slowly. I continued working, but couldn't shake the feeling that something was off. It wasn't just the usual creepiness of being alone in a mine. This was different. I felt watched. I stopped and listened. Nothing but the soft drip of water and my own breathing. "You're being paranoid," I said aloud, my voice bouncing back at me from the tunnel walls. I pushed forward another 50 yards or so and came to a small chamber where several tunnels converged. Perfect spot to take some readings. I set up my tripod and started working. That's when I heard it, a scraping sound, like bootsteps on gravel, but slower, deliberate. I froze, listening intently. It stopped. "Hello," I called out, immediately feeling stupid. No one else was scheduled to be down here today. No response, just the echo of my own voice fading into the darkness. I turned back to my equipment, trying to ignore the prickle of unease crawling up my spine. Just as I was adjusting my transit level, my headlamp flickered again, but this time it went completely dark for a good 3 seconds. In those 3 seconds of complete darkness, something changed in the chamber. When my light came back on, I wasn't alone anymore. About 15 feet away at the entrance to one of the other tunnels stood a figure, or at least something shaped like a person. It was like a shadow, but darker than the darkness around it. No features I could make out, just a solid black silhouette of a man wearing what looked like old-style mining gear, complete with a helmet. My blood turned to ice. I couldn't move, couldn't speak. The figure didn't move either. It just stood there, facing me. No eyes visible, but I knew, I absolutely knew, it was looking right at me. "Who's there?" I finally managed to say, my voice cracking. "This area is restricted without proper clearance." No response. No movement. I reached for my phone, thinking I'd use the flashlight for extra illumination. But as I moved, so did the figure. Just a slight turn of its head, tracking my movement. Then it took a step toward me. I'd love to say I stood my ground or challenged it again, but that would be a lie. Pure instinct took over, and I bolted, grabbed my backpack, left the tripod and transit level behind, and ran like hell back the way I'd come. The whole time I could hear those scraping footsteps behind me, not running, just walking steadily. Somehow that was worse. My headlamp flickered constantly as I ran, plunging me into darkness every few seconds. Each time it came back on, I was terrified I'd see that figure right in front of me. I don't remember much of the journey out, just running, stumbling, my breath coming in ragged gasps. When I finally burst out into the fading afternoon light, I nearly collapsed from relief. I looked back at the mine entrance, half expecting to see the shadow figure standing there, watching me. But there was nothing. The next day, I went back with Dave and two other guys to retrieve the equipment I'd left behind. I made up some bullshit about feeling sick and having to leave in a hurry. They gave me shit about it, but helped me look. We never found my equipment, not in that chamber, not anywhere in the mine. According to Dave, we even went down the exact same tunnels I'd mapped the day before, but the chamber where I'd seen the figure just wasn't there. Story 8. We lived in Tacoma, Washington, me, my dad, and our fat old cat, Rufus. I was around 6 or 7, somewhere in that weird stretch of childhood where you're not a baby anymore, but you still sleep with a nightlight and hate closets being open. Our place wasn't creepy or anything. A basic two-bedroom rental in a quiet triplex. Nothing old, nothing falling apart. Just a regular place. No one ever said anything about ghosts. I didn't even think about ghosts back then. Not until that night. It was one of those nights where I just couldn't fall asleep. No reason. I wasn't scared. I wasn't sick. I just couldn't switch off my brain. I remember lying there, staring at the ceiling, counting the glow-in-the-dark stars I'd stuck up there with Dad a few months before. The bedroom door was open just a bit, enough for Rufus to come and go. He hated closed doors, used to cry and scratch until someone opened them, so we always left it cracked. I turned onto my side, just restless. That's when I saw it. There was something outside the door. Just beyond the doorway, half in shadow, something pale, white, almost glowing, was standing in the hallway. It wasn't a trick of the light. I know what I saw. It was tall, humanoid, but not a person. No details. Just a shape, like someone had taken the silhouette of a person and erased all the features. I couldn't tell if it had a face. It was like a blank, solid white smear. Too smooth, too still. It didn't move, didn't shift, didn't blink. I stared at it. My whole body locked up, like every part of me had hit some invisible wall. I wanted to call out, "Dad?" But the word got stuck. I don't even think I breathed. I just watched it. My heart was beating so hard it made my ears ring. I remember thinking, "That's not right. That's not supposed to be there." And then it moved, but not like a person. It didn't step or turn or walk. It just slid. Like someone pulled it across the floor without lifting its feet. It moved sideways out of the doorway, still facing forward. Or at least I think it was facing forward, I don't know. It didn't have a face. It just drifted out of view like it was on rails, completely silent. I laid there frozen for what felt like hours. I couldn't bring myself to get up. I couldn't even sit up. My body didn't work right. I kept waiting for it to come back. It never did. Eventually, I must have passed out from sheer exhaustion because the next thing I remember was waking up in daylight. I convinced myself it was just a dream, a weird, realistic, middle-of-the-night hallucination. Kids see weird things, right? I told myself that over and over, but then came the call. It was the next evening, around 6. We were just getting back from the park. I'd been playing in the grass, chasing a rubber ball, while Dad scrolled through his phone on the bench. On the walk home, his phone rang. He answered, and I remember his face went pale. Not surprised, not confused, just instantly drained, like someone flipped a switch in him. He didn't say much, just nodded, said, "Okay," and hung up. I asked, "What happened?" He didn't answer right away. We walked the rest of the way in silence, and when we got inside, he knelt down next to me and said very quietly, "Grandma passed away last night." I stared at him. I didn't really understand what that meant at first. He said, "She died in her sleep." Around midnight, and right then, every hair on my arm stood up. Midnight. That was the exact time I saw that thing in the hallway. I didn't say anything. I couldn't. It felt like if I even mentioned what I saw, it would come back. I just nodded and walked to my room and shut the door. I didn't turn on the light. I sat on the bed and looked at the same crack in the doorway I'd looked through the night before. That's when the questions started crawling in. What if it wasn't a dream? What if it wasn't random? I hadn't been thinking about Grandma. I didn't even know she was sick. The timing was too perfect, Too sharp, too deliberate. Was it her? Number, it didn't feel like her. That thing, whatever it was, wasn't warm or comforting. It didn't feel human at all. It felt wrong, like it was wearing a human shape, but didn't know how to be one. I started sleeping with the door completely shut after that. Rufus didn't like it, but I didn't care. I'd rather deal with the sound of him scratching all night than see that shape again. I never did. Not once. It never came back. Nothing weird happened in the house after that. No creaking floors, no lights flickering, no cold spots. Just that one night. People always ask, "Do you believe in ghosts?" And I say, "I didn't until I did." Because once is enough. You don't need to see it twice. You don't need confirmation or a second opinion. When something like that happens, something impossible, you feel it in your bones. It doesn't fade. It doesn't become a funny story you tell at sleepovers. It's not a dream you brush off. It sits in the back of your head like a locked box. You never forget it. You just stop talking about it. I don't care if anyone believes me. I'm not trying to convince anyone. I'd prefer they didn't believe me, because that means they haven't seen it. And if there's one thing I know, it's this. Once you've seen something like that, you never go back to normal. You just learn to live around it. Story 9. I never used to think twice about old houses. Growing up in rural Vermont, most homes had their fair share of creaky floors and drafty corners. But what happened when I was 12 changed everything for me. This was back in 2011. My parents were close with the Hendersons, who had just moved into this Victorian-style house about a mile from us. The place was at least 100 years old, but they'd done a decent job fixing it up. New paint, updated kitchen, that kind of stuff. Still had all the original hardwood floors and those weird little rooms Victorian houses always seem to have. The Hendersons had a baby girl, Emma, who was only about 8 months old. They didn't know many people in town yet, so when they needed someone to watch her while they went to some dinner thing, my mom volunteered me. I'd babysat my cousins before, so it wasn't a big deal. "Just call if anything comes up," Mrs. Henderson said, handing me a list with emergency numbers. "Emma usually sleeps through the night, so you should be fine." "Got it," I said, trying to sound more confident than I felt. The house felt off somehow. Maybe it was just because I wasn't used to it. After they left, I played with Emma for a while. She was cute, all big eyes and chubby cheeks. Around 7:30, she started getting fussy, so I put her to bed in her crib upstairs. The nursery was this small room at the end of the hall, painted light yellow with little ducks around the border. Once Emma was asleep, I went back downstairs and parked myself on the couch with my Nintendo DS. The house was quiet except for the occasional creak, which I figured was normal for an old place. I was deep into my game when I heard it. A different kind of creak, heavier, like someone stepping on a loose floorboard. I paused my game and listened. Nothing for a minute, then there it was again, definitely upstairs. "Hello," I called out, feeling stupid immediately. No one else was home. I tried to go back to my game, but then I heard another sound. It was like, I don't know how to describe it exactly, like someone dragging their hand along the wall upstairs. My heart started racing. I told myself it was just the house settling or whatever, but I couldn't shake the feeling that something was wrong. I needed to check on Emma. I crept up the stairs, each step making that awful creaking sound. The upstairs hallway was dark except for the nightlight coming from Emma's room. When I reached her doorway, I froze. Emma was sitting straight up in her crib, completely silent, not crying, not babbling, just staring. She was looking at the door across the hall, which led to a narrow passageway toward what I think was once a servant's quarters or something. The door was open just a crack. I whispered, "Emma? You okay, sweetie?" She didn't look at me, just kept staring at that door. I should have grabbed her right then. Instead, I walked over to the door, my hands shaking as I reached for the knob. I pushed it open. The hallway beyond was pitch black. As the door swung wide, a blast of freezing air hit my legs. It was like opening a freezer, but worse. The cold felt wrong somehow, heavy, and there were no windows in that hallway, no vents, nothing that could explain it. Then I saw it. At the far end of the hall, a shadow moved, Not like a normal shadow cast by something. This moved on its own. It was darker than the darkness around it, shaped vaguely like a person, but wrong. Too tall, too thin. It slid across the wall and disappeared into a room at the end. I couldn't breathe, couldn't move. Then Emma made the sound, not a cry, more like a whimper, and it snapped me out of it. I ran to her crib, scooped her up, and bolted downstairs. My hands were shaking so bad I could barely lock the door to the small study off the living room. I sat there with Emma in my lap, both of us facing the door, until I heard the Henderson's car pull into the driveway hours later. I didn't tell them what happened. What could I say? But when Mrs. Henderson asked if everything went okay, Emma looked right at me with those big baby eyes, and I swear she knew. She remembered. I never babysat there again, made up excuses whenever they asked. A month later, I overheard my mom talking to Mrs. Henderson on the phone. "What do you mean Emma won't sleep in her room anymore?" my mom asked. I didn't hear the answer, but I didn't need to. I already knew. Story 10. I've always been a skeptic. Growing up in Vermont with a scientist dad, I was taught to question everything and look for logical explanations. Ghosts were just figments of overactive imaginations or misinterpretations of natural phenomena. At least that's what I believed until last winter. This happened about 7 months ago when I was living in an old converted Victorian in Burlington with my two roommates, Derek and Mitch. The house itself wasn't particularly creepy, just your typical student housing with questionable plumbing and drafty windows. We'd been there for almost 2 years without incident. It was a Tuesday in January, brutally cold outside. I remember because I had an early clinical rotation at the hospital, and I was dreading the walk to my car in the pre-dawn darkness. The house was silent at 5:30 a.m. Both my roommates worked restaurant jobs and wouldn't be up for hours. I stumbled into the bathroom, still half asleep, and turned the shower to scalding. The pipes creaked and groaned as they always did. Our bathroom was tiny, just a shower stall, toilet, and sink crammed together, with a flimsy, hollow-core door that didn't even lock properly. The hot water helped chase away the chill and the sleepiness. I was mentally reviewing my day's schedule when I shut off the water. That's when I heard it. Knock, knock, knock. Three distinct raps on the bathroom door. Not the gentle kind like someone checking if the bathroom was occupied. These were deliberate, confident knocks. "Yeah, just finishing up," I called out, figuring one of my roommates had an early shift I didn't know about. I quickly dried off, wrapped the towel around my waist, and waited for a response. Nothing, just silence. Knock, knock, knock. The same pattern, same intensity. Irritated now, I yanked open the door, ready to ask what was so urgent. The hallway was empty. "Hello?" I called out. No answer. The landing light was off, but I could see down the short hallway to both my roommates' doors, both closed. I checked the time, 5:45 a.m., way too early for either of them to be up. I told myself it was nothing. Maybe the pipes or the house settling in the cold. Old houses make weird noises, right? I hurried back to my room, locking the door behind me, something I never normally did. As I got dressed, I kept glancing at my door. The house seemed unnaturally quiet now, like it was holding its breath. I could hear the wind outside, the hum of my space heater, but nothing else. Then, knock, knock, knock. On my bedroom door this time, the same distinct pattern. My heart jumped into my throat. "Who is it?" I called out, trying to keep my voice steady. Silence. I grabbed my phone to text my roommates, fingers trembling slightly. Me. "Hey, did one of you just knock on my door?" I knew they wouldn't answer. They'd be asleep. But I needed to do something. Knock, knock, knock. Louder this time, more insistent. "Derek? Mitch? This isn't funny," I said, my voice rising despite my efforts to stay calm. Then I watched in horror as my doorknob began to turn. Slowly, deliberately. I'd locked it, I know I had, but it was turning anyway. The door began to open, inch by inch. I couldn't move, couldn't breathe. My body felt frozen as I stared at the widening gap. The door opened fully, revealing the dark hallway beyond. Empty. No one was there. But then I felt it. A cold draft that shouldn't have been possible in our overheated house. It swept past me, raising goosebumps on my arms. The air in my room suddenly felt heavy, oppressive, like something was pressing down on my chest. For a split second, I thought I saw something in the corner of my eye, a shadow darker than the darkness, a vague human shape. Then my bedroom door slammed shut with such force that the pictures on my wall rattled. I didn't sleep that night, didn't go to my clinical rotation either. I sat on my bed with the lights on until I heard my roommates getting up hours later. When I told them what happened, they exchanged looks I couldn't interpret. Finally, Derek said, "You're in the front bedroom, right? The one that used to be Mrs. Wilcox's?" "Yeah, why?" "The landlord didn't tell you the story when you picked that room?" Mitch asked. Apparently, the elderly woman who'd owned the house before it was converted to apartments had died in my bedroom. She'd fallen and couldn't reach the phone. They said she'd knocked on the walls for hours trying to get someone to hear her. No one did. I moved out the next week. Some things you just can't explain away, no matter how hard you try. Here. Thanks for watching. Don't leave before leaving a like to this video. Also, hit the subscribe button to support my work. And as always, have a horrific nightmare, my dear.
Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips, with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.